Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, March 22nd, 2022. Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson getting questions from senators on hot-button issues, including abortion, critical race theory, and Republican accusations that she went too easy sentencing defendants convicted of child pornography crimes. She's also asked whether the Supreme Court oral argument should be televised. Coming up, day two of the Senate Judiciary Committee confirmation hearing, and we'll talk about it with Josh Gerstein, legal affairs reporter with Politico. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan laying out the agenda for President Joe Biden's trip to Europe this week, meeting with NATO leaders in Brussels and then visiting Poland. As Russia's war in Ukraine continues to bog down on the ground against intense Ukrainian defenses, but it continues its damaging and deadly airstrikes in Ukrainian cities. And United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres says he believes the time is right for a peace agreement between Russia and Ukraine, that he sees the elements of diplomatic progress. And we start with the Senate Judiciary Committee confirmation hearing for nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to Associate Justice on the Supreme Court. Each senator on the committee getting 30 minutes to question the witness in the first round of questions, a second round for at least some of the senators, likely. Washington Post writing, Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson defended her record as a federal public defender and district court judge on her second day of confirmation hearings for a seat on the Supreme Court. Democrats used their early questions to give Jackson a chance to respond to Republican accusations that she's been too soft on crime. Republican senators continued that line of attack through the day. First to question the nominee, the committee chair, Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois.
The senator from Missouri has in his tweets said of your position on this issue, Judge Jackson has a pattern of letting child porn offenders off the hook for their appalling crimes, both as a judge and a policymaker. She's been advocating it since law school. This goes beyond soft on crime, the senator said. I'm concerned this is a record that endangers our children. I thought about his charges as I watched you and your family listening carefully yesterday and what impact it might have had on you personally to know that your daughters, husband, parents, family, and friends were hearing the charges that your implementation of this law, sentencing, endangered children. Could you tell us what was going through your mind at that point?
Thank you, Senator. As a mother and a judge who has had to deal with these cases, I was thinking that nothing could be further from the truth. These are some of the most difficult cases that a judge has to deal with because we're talking about pictures of sex abuse of children. We're talking about graphic descriptions that judges have to read and consider when they decide how to sentence in these cases. And there's a statute that tells judges what they're supposed to do. Congress has decided what it is that a judge has to do in this and any other case when they sentence. And that statute doesn't say, look only at the guidelines and stop. The statute doesn't say, impose the highest possible penalty for this sickening and egregious crime. The statute says, calculate the guidelines, but also look at various aspects of this offense and impose a sentence that is, quote, sufficient but not greater than necessary to promote the purposes of punishment. And in every case, when I am dealing with something like this, it is important to me to make sure that the children's perspective, the children's voices, are represented in my sentencings. And what that means is that for every defendant who comes before me and who suggests, as they often do, that they're just a looker, that these crimes don't really matter, they've collected these things on the internet and it's fine, I tell them about the victim statements that have come in to me as a judge. I tell them about the adults who are former child sex abuse victims who tell me that they will never have a normal adult relationship because of this abuse. I tell them about the ones who say, I went into prostitution, I fell into drugs because I was trying to suppress the hurt that was done to me as an infant. And the one that was the most telling to me that I describe at almost every one of these sentencings when I look in the eyes of a defendant who is weeping because I'm giving him a significant sentence. What I say to him is, do you know that there is someone who has written to me and who has told me that she has developed agoraphobia? She cannot leave her house because she thinks that everyone she meets will have seen her, will have seen her pictures on the internet. They're out there forever. At the most vulnerable time of her life. And so she's paralyzed. I tell that story to every child porn defendant as a part of my sentencings so that they understand what they have done. I say to them that there's only a market for this kind of material because there are lookers, that you are contributing to child sex abuse. And then I impose a significant sentence and all of the additional restraints that are available in the law. These people are looking at 20, 30, 40 years of supervision. They can't use their computers in a normal way for decades. I am imposing all of those constraints because I understand how significant, how damaging, how horrible this crime is.
Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson questioned by Senator Dick Durbin, chair of the Judiciary Committee. The senator also asked her about her judicial philosophy. She said, I'm acutely aware that as a judge in our system, I have limited power, and I'm trying in every case to stay in my lane. And she said she would not bring personal views or policy preferences into decisions. If confirmed, Judge Jackson will be the first African-American woman ever on the Supreme Court. Senator Ted Cruz, Republican from Texas, used part of his question time to ask the nominee about critical race theory, or CRT, and the judge's connections to Georgetown Day School, an independent K-12 school in the Washington, D.C. area. Judge Jackson serves on the school's board of trustees.
So, Judge Jackson, all of us will agree that no one should be discriminated against because of race. When you just testified a minute ago that you didn't know if critical race theory was taught in K-12, I will confess I find that statement a little hard to reconcile with the public record, because if you look at the Georgetown Day School's curriculum, it is filled and overflowing with critical race theory. That among the books that are either assigned or recommended, they include Critical Race Theory, an introduction. They include The End of Policing, an advocacy for abolishing police. They include How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram Kendi. They include literally stacks and stacks of books, and I'll tell you two of the ones that were most stunning. They include a book called Anti-Racist Baby by Ibram Kendi. And there are portions of this book that I find really quite remarkable. One portion of the book says, babies are taught to be racist or anti-racist. There is no neutrality. Another portion of the book, they recommend to babies confess when being racist. Now, this is a book that is taught at Georgetown Day School to students in pre-K through second grade, so 4 through 7 years old. Do you agree with this book that is being taught with kids that babies are racist?
Senator, I do not believe that any child should be made to feel as though they are racist or though they are not valued or though they are less than, that they are victims, that they are oppressors. I don't believe in any of that. But what I will say is that when you asked me whether or not this was taught in schools, critical race theory, my understanding is that critical race theory as an academic theory is taught in law schools. And to the extent that you were asking the question, I understood you to be addressing public schools. Georgetown Day School, just like the religious school that Justice Barrett was on the board of, is a private school.
Okay, so you agree critical race theory is taught at Georgetown Day School?
I don't know, because the board is not, the board does not control the curriculum. The board does not focus on that. That's not what we do as board members, so I'm actually not sure.
Well, and I'll note that the board is chaired by Professor Fairfax, your college roommate who introduced you yesterday, so the two of you serve on the board together. Another book that is on the summer reading for third through fifth grade is a book called Stamp for Kids, again by Ibram Kendi. I read the entirety of the book, and I will say it is an astonishing book. On page 33, it asks the question, can we send white people back to Europe? That's on 33. That's what's being given to 8 and 9 years old. It also, on page 115, says the idea that we should pretend not to see racism is connected to the idea that we should pretend not to see color. It's called color blindness. Skipping ahead, here's what's wrong with this. It's ridiculous. Skin color is something we all absolutely see. Skipping ahead, so to pretend not to see color is pretty convenient if you don't actually want to stamp out racism in the first place. Now, what this book argues for is the exact opposite of what Dr. King spoke about on the floor of the Lincoln Memorial. And are you comfortable with these ideas being taught to children as young as 4 and in respect to the first book, as young as 8 and 9 in respect to the second book?
Senator, I have not reviewed any of those books, any of those ideas. They don't come up in my work as a judge, which I'm respectfully here to address. In my work as a judge, which is evidenced from my near decade on the bench.
Okay, good. Then let's go back to your work as a judge.
Senator Ted Cruz, Republican from Texas, with Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. The C-SPAN networks are covering the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings gavel to gavel on C-SPAN Radio, C-SPAN Television, and on our free C-SPAN Now mobile video app. If you miss any of the live coverage, it's all archived at cspan.org. Hearing room also open to the public. USA Today writing that during a break in questioning, Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Dick Durbin speaking with Supreme Court Sherpa former Senator Doug Jones, Democrat from Alabama. And Durbin then took photos with a group of black women who identified themselves as law school deans. Other guests snapped photos and took selfies with Jackson's parents. More questions to the nominee. Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat from California, asking about abortion. She wants to know if Judge Jackson agrees that the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision that established the constitutional right to an abortion and the 1992 Planned Parenthood v. Casey decision that affirmed that right are settled law and precedent. Feinstein noting that current Supreme Court Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett said so when questioned by her during their confirmation hearings.
Roe and Casey are the settled law of the Supreme Court concerning the right to terminate a woman's pregnancy. They have established a framework that the court has reaffirmed. And in order to revisit, as Justice Barrett said, the Supreme Court looks at various factors because stare decisis is a very important principle. It provides and establishes predictability, stability. It also serves as a restraint in this way on the exercise of judicial authority because the court looks at whether or not precedents are relied upon, whether they're workable, in addition to whether or not they're wrong, and other factors as well. So I agree with both of those statements that you read.
Well, let me add one to that, and then we'll move on. I'm particularly interested in the case of Roe v. Wade. Roe was decided by nearly 50 years ago, and it's been reaffirmed over a dozen times since then. So my question is this: does Roe v. Wade have the status of being a case that is a super precedent? And what other Supreme Court cases do you believe have that status?
Well, Senator, all Supreme Court cases are precedential, they're binding, and their principles and their rulings have to be followed. Roe and Casey, as you say, have been reaffirmed by the court and have been relied upon. And reliance is one of the factors that the court considers when it seeks to revisit, or when it's asked to revisit, revisit a precedent. And in all cases, those the precedents of the Supreme Court would have to be reviewed pursuant to those factors, because stare decisis is very important.
Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Questions from Senator Dianne Feinstein. Another issue that came up today, whether the Supreme Court oral argument should be televised. Right now, only live audio is provided by the court. Question from Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa, committee ranking Republican.
On another subject, kind of personal to me over a long period of time and about half of this committee, but it's a controversial issue even within this committee. I favor allowing Supreme Court hearings to be televised. What's your view on this? How would you feel about cameras in the courtroom, which about 45 of our states allow?
Well, Senator, I would want to discuss with the other justices their views and understand all of the various potential issues related to cameras in the courtroom before I took a position on it.
I think that's a fair answer at this point.
With more on today's Supreme Court confirmation hearing, we're joined by Josh Gerstein, senior legal affairs reporter with Politico. Thanks for being with us. From the senator's questions today and the nominee's answers, what did we learn about what kind of justice Ketanji Brown Jackson would be?
Well, I think she's going to be a very cautious justice based on the way she's approached these hearings. Until really well into the session, I didn't even really see a moment where her responses were not entirely measured and deliberate. We had a little bit of an altercation with Senator Ted Cruz after he raised some critical race theory issues related to a school that Judge Jackson serves on the board of. But aside from that, it's been a pretty respectful hearing. We are hearing some complaints, as we would expect from Republicans, that she's not being direct in answering the questions that they've put to her on various issues. But thus far, there hasn't been any dramatic showdown. Perhaps the most dramatic showdowns have actually been, between the individual senators. We had one between Senator Lindsey Graham and Senator Dick Durbin, the chairman of the committee, over Guantanamo, for example. But for the most part, she hasn't been sort of in the line of fire on those things.
Right off the bat, the committee chair, Dick Durbin, got to an issue that's been raised by some Republican senators, and that's the child pornography cases and the accusations that she's been lenient with the sentences. How did that play out?
Well, yeah, so it was interesting that he made that effort to pre-bud or disarm the Republicans on that issue before they even had a chance to raise it directly with her. And, she emphasized, as we expected, that she's a mother of two, and she repeatedly called these sorts of crimes involving children horrible. On the other hand, she did say rather directly that there are problems with the way the sentencing guidelines for this particular type of offense in the federal system are set up. And she argued that some of it is technologically outdated because it's so easy to download large volumes of information, the way that the sentencing guidelines make distinctions between people that only have a little bit of child pornography and have a lot of it is somewhat meaningless at this point. And judges have been asking Congress to address this for more than a decade, certainly, and doing so without success. So she certainly, I think, parried those claims. And it was difficult, I think, seeing her sitting there to think that she somehow is sympathetic to people that commit these sorts of offenses.
Another issue that she would not answer, and it's been brought up by the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell that he would like to hear an answer, is whether the Supreme Court should be expanded.
Yeah, so this is a question that we've had other justices, sitting justices, speak out on. Justice Stephen Breyer, who's the one that Judge Jackson clerked for, the justice Judge Jackson clerked for, has said basically that he's opposed to efforts to expand the court. I think Justice Elena Kagan has said the same thing. Jackson was not willing to opine on the subject and basically said that she would not follow would not follow the lead of those justices. She essentially argued that it was up to Congress. She said that in doing so, she was taking the same position that Justice Amy Coney Barrett did when she was being confirmed to the high court. That's not exactly what Barrett said, and Republicans are trying to make an issue out of that. But the bottom line was that she was unwilling to weigh in on that rather controversial issue, you know, which Republicans describe as court packing.
We're talking with Josh Gerstein from Politico. Another interesting moment was Senator Cornyn asking the judge about why she called former President George W. Bush and former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld war criminals. And that was later, there was some fact checking going on in a break. What happened there?
Right. So this was perhaps the most pointed questioning. The most fireworks of the morning came from Senator Lindsey Graham asking her questions about her role defending Guantanamo prisoners. There was a brief she filed in apparently several cases that alleged that it was a war crime to torture these suspects who were being held at Guantanamo Bay. Graham used the word that Bush and then Defense Secretary Rumsfeld were being accused of being war criminals, and there must have been a way to handle this case without accusing individuals of being war criminals. Durbin then came back after the break with some more information on that case and said she'd not actually used the word war criminals, which is true, but she did accuse them of war crimes, which is pretty close to the same thing. On the other hand, she was representing these detainees, and she had a duty to defend them zealously, and therefore she needed to put forward all the arguments they might have about why their detention was illegal. And I think many lawyers would say that, you know, she was essentially doing her job. We should also note when she filed these briefs, she was a federal defender working for the U.S. government, essentially. So it was basically something she was assigned to do and had to execute it. And that's the way she portrayed it at the hearing.
And final question, the conventional wisdom is that all Democrats on the committee will be voting to confirm this nominee. Any indication whether any Republicans might join them and vote yes so far?
I mean, I haven't seen any. I would be a little bit surprised if she picks up many Republicans from the Judiciary Committee. It tends to be a fairly polarized committee, especially on these issues of justice and the courts. Could she pick up a few other Republicans around the Senate? I think that that's totally possible, especially if it's clear she's going to be confirmed anyway, and the Democrats have the power to do that with Vice President Harris's potential tie-breaking vote. I think it's likely she'll pick up a few Republicans, but not many more than that.
Josh Gerstein is senior legal affairs reporter for Politico. Follow him on Twitter at Josh Gerstein and his stories at Politico.com. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
The White House says that President Biden has been following the Supreme Court confirmation hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee. An update today from the White House Deputy Press Secretary Chris Meager.
The president watched portions of Judge Jackson's hearing yesterday and today and is proud of the way she is showcasing her extraordinary qualifications, her experience, and her even-handedness. Her dedication to following the facts, the law, and our Constitution as an independent judge is clear. He was also moved by the grace and dignity she has shown, the deference to senators, and the level of detail she is offering, reinforcing the value of her experience, her intellect, and the strength of her character. The president was particularly struck when, reacting to Senator Leahy raising the broad support she had received from the law enforcement community, Judge Jackson spoke about her family members who have served as police officers, saying, "I know what it's like to have loved ones who go off to protect and to serve, and the fear of not knowing whether or not they're going to come home again because of crime in the community. Those are not abstract concepts or political slogans to me." As a former chairman of the Judiciary Committee, President Biden also appreciated her respect for the intent of lawmakers and the text of the law. He appreciated Judge Jackson's commitment to stay in the lane of judges prescribed by the Constitution and her highlighting the importance of precedent. He was also struck by how she swiftly dismantled conspiracy theories put forward in bad faith. They've been debunked by numerous fact checks, experts, and the record itself. In selecting Judge Jackson, President Biden sought the opinions of Republicans and Democrats who made clear they wanted someone of deep experience in the mold of Justice Breyer. Today's testimony and Judge Jackson's endorsements by leading conservative jurists and some of the biggest law enforcement organizations in our country make clear she is indeed in Justice Breyer's mold.
White House Deputy Press Secretary Chris Meager in the White House briefing room. By the way, he led the White House briefing today because White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki putting out a statement that reads, "Today, in preparation for travel to Europe, I took a PRC test this morning. That test came back positive, which means I will be adhering to CDC guidance and no longer be traveling on the president's trip to Europe. I had two socially distanced meetings with the president yesterday, and the president is not considered a close contact as defined by CDC guidance. I'm sharing the news of my positive test today out of an abundance of transparency." The president tested negative today via PCR test. Statement from the press secretary, Jen Psaki, concluding, "Thanks to the vaccine, I have only experienced mild symptoms. In alignment with White House COVID-19 protocols, I will work from home and plan to return to work in person at the conclusion of a 5-day isolation period and a negative test." White House Deputy Press Secretary Chris Meager adding today, "No members of the press who attended the briefing yesterday are considered to be close contacts. We are currently conducting contact tracing." More on the president's trip to Europe and Russia's war against Ukraine when Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast on the C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. From the Daily Mail in London, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Italy must stop being a resort for murderers and urged the country to ban Russian ships from its port as he told lawmakers in a video address this morning that Ukraine is on the brink of surviving its war. Zelensky highlighting the brutality of Russia's invasion, saying torture, rape, and kidnappings akin to the Nazi occupation had become common. He said for Russian troops, Ukraine is the gates of Europe, where they want to break in, but barbarism must not be allowed to pass. We are on the brink of survival. That from the Daily Mail. President Joe Biden will be traveling to Europe on Wednesday, meeting with the leaders of the countries in the NATO alliance in Belgium, NATO headquarters, and then a visit to Poland, which borders Ukraine and has been accepting countless refugees fleeing the war. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan speaking to reporters.
He will attend an emergency NATO summit, joined by the leaders of the other 29 NATO allies. He will join the G7 leaders, and he will address the 27 leaders of the European Union at a session of the European Council. He will have the opportunity to coordinate on the next phase of military assistance to Ukraine. He will join our partners in imposing further sanctions on Russia and tightening the existing sanctions to crack down on evasion and to ensure robust enforcement. He will work with allies on longer-term adjustments to NATO force posture on the eastern flank. He will announce joint action on enhancing European energy security and reducing Europe's dependence on Russian gas at long last. He will announce further American contributions to a coordinated humanitarian response to ease the suffering of civilians inside Ukraine and to respond to the growing flow of refugees. From Brussels, President Biden will travel to Poland, where he will engage with U.S. troops who are now helping to defend NATO territory, and he will meet with experts involved in the humanitarian response. He will also hold a bilateral meeting with President Duda of Poland. I'll leave further details on the schedule and program for each of these aspects of the trip to our trusty communications and press team. Let me close with this. There will be hard days ahead in Ukraine, hardest for the Ukrainian troops on the front lines and the civilians under Russian bombardment. This war will not end easily or rapidly. For the past few months, the West has been united. The President is traveling to Europe to ensure we stay united, to cement our collective resolve, to send a powerful message that we are prepared and committed to this for as long as it takes, and to advance our response on all three critical fronts that I've described, helping the Ukrainian people defend themselves, imposing and increasing costs on Russia, and reinforcing the Western alliance.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan with reporters in the White House briefing room. He was asked by a reporter whether the U.S., like Ukrainian President Zelensky, thinks the war is winnable by Ukraine.
Is it the policy of this government that Ukraine should win this? It should eject Russia and regain its sovereignty and its freedom?
We've said from the outset that we are unwavering in our commitment to Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Within the internationally recognized borders of Ukraine, we remain committed to that as our proposition for this. But in the immediate day-to-day of this conflict, our focus is on ensuring that Ukraine has the tools that it needs to defend itself and to be able to effectively ensure that Russia cannot achieve its objectives in Ukraine. That's what we're focused on right now. But on the basic proposition of Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, from day one of the Biden administration, we have not wavered an inch on it.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. Based on the battles from the Associated Press, they write Ukrainian forces fought off continuing Russian efforts to occupy Mariupol and claim to have retaken a strategic suburb of Kyiv on Tuesday, mounting a defense so dogged that it is stoking fears Russia's Vladimir Putin will escalate the war to new heights. Vladimir Putin referring to the Russian president. On Capitol Hill, many Republicans have been advocating for supplying Ukraine with more and better weaponry. Senator Joni Ernst, Republican from Iowa, just back from a trip to Europe.
Folks, we are hitting the one month point for the war in Ukraine. And over this last weekend, I had the great honor of leading a bipartisan delegation of 10 senators. And on this CODEL, we were able to visit Germany and Poland. And I'd really like to highlight two of the meetings that were very compelling in Poland. And the first one was our meeting at a refugee reception center near the border, just several miles from the Ukrainian border. And while we were there, we were able to see the women and the children and the elderly people that maybe had one or two bags of belongings as they had fled Ukraine. Many of them looked so weary and just truly shell-shocked because that's what they are. We were able to speak with a woman, Katerina, and she had two small children, ages 8 and 6. And her plea to the United States was, please do more. We need more. The humanitarian support is wonderful, but they can't win the war if we and our NATO partners are not providing them a means to push the invading Russians out of Ukraine. She wants to go home. That's her biggest wish, is to go home, and yet it's not safe for her or her children. She has no idea if she will see her husband again. This is what the Ukrainians are facing. So that was the first meeting. And as a mother, my heart is breaking My heart is breaking for those children that don't know if they'll see their father or their mother again. The second meeting was with a group of women who belong to the Ukrainian civil society. Those women were so passionate, and they echoed Katerina's thoughts as well, in that send us lethal aid. Let us win this war. They said, we can win this war. We just need the means to do it. Where is the lethal aid? Things are moving so slowly. We need to get the aid to Ukraine as quickly as possible. So, as a mother, my heart breaks for all of those children and those refugees. But as a soldier, my gut instinct is that we need to help protect these people. The way that we can do it right now is by providing that lethal aid, and we can do it as quickly as possible. So, folks, I'm encouraging the administration to step up and respond to the needs of Ukraine. The very least we can do is fight for this democracy. It is a fight for freedom.
Senator Joni Ernst with reporters on Capitol Hill. A story at Newsweek claims about the existence and implementation of a new world order have spread online after President Joe Biden used the phrase in a speech. While the phrase new world order is generally used to denote a significant geopolitical change, it can also designate a conspiracy theory that stipulates a secretive globalist authority is seeking to control the world under a totalitarian regime and strip sovereign countries and its citizens of their freedom. That was from Newsweek. Here's what President Biden said Monday night at the Business Roundtable's CEO quarterly meeting in Washington, D.C.
You know, we are at an inflection point, I believe, in the world economy. Not just the world economy, in the world. It occurs every three or four generations. As one of the top military people said to me in a secure meeting the other day, 60 million people died between 1900 and 1946. And since then, we established a liberal world order, and that hadn't happened in a long while. A lot of people dying, but nowhere near the chaos. And now is a time when things are shifting. There's going to be a new world order out there, and we've got to lead it. And we've got to unite the rest of the free world in doing it.
President Biden, Monday night. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has been convicted of fraud and contempt of court, sentenced to 9 years in a maximum security prison. AP writes that it was a trial Kremlin critics see as an attempt to keep President Vladimir Putin's most ardent foe in prison for as long as possible. Reaction from the U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price.
I just ask you about Alexei Navalny. Do you have any response to a Russian court sentencing him to 9 additional years in prison today?
We do. We strongly condemn the Russian Federation's orchestration of a sham trial to convict Alexei Navalny on further spurious charges and sentencing him to 9 more years in a high security prison. We note with grave concern that the court's sham ruling is the latest in a series of attempts to silence Navalny and other opposition figures and independent voices who have been critical of Russian authorities, including Navalny's near-fatal poisoning with a nerve agent by Russian security services in 2020. This disturbing decision, the one announced today, is another example of the Russian government's widening crackdown on dissent and freedom of expression, which is intended to hide the Kremlin's brutal war and unprovoked war against Ukraine. Confident political leaders do not fear competing voices, nor do they commit violence against or unjustly detain political opponents. Russian people, like people everywhere, deserve a government that supports an open marketplace of ideas. Deserve a government that supports transparency and accountability, as well as an independent judiciary, and the ability to exercise their human rights of freedom of expression or peaceful assembly without fear of retribution. We urge the Russian government to provide a level playing field for all political parties and candidates seeking to compete in the electoral process. We demand his immediate and unconditional release.
State Department spokesman Ned Price. Alexei Navalny tweeting after the sentencing, "The best support for me and other political prisoners is not sympathy and kind words, but actions. Any activity against the deceitful and thievish Putin's regime, any opposition to these war criminals. In 2013, after hearing my first verdict, I wrote this, and now I will repeat it. Don't be idle." The toad sitting on an oil pipe will not overthrow itself. I hug and love everyone. Those tweets from Alexei Navalny. Ukraine's defense ministry saying about 15,300 Russian troops have been killed since the war began a month ago, along with the loss of over 500 Russian tanks, over 1,500 Russian armored combat vehicles, and over 250 artillery systems from Russia. Russia says that just under 500 of its troops have been killed. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres saying today that his discussions with officials indicate there is enough on the table to cease hostilities now and reach a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine. Guterres speaking at the UN in New York City.
10 million Ukrainians have been forced from their homes and are on the move. But the war is going nowhere fast. For more than 2 weeks, Mariupol has been encircled by the Russian army and relentlessly bombed, shelled, and attacked. For what? Even if Mariupol falls, Ukraine cannot be conquered city by city, street by street, house by house. The only outcome to all these is more suffering, more destruction, and more horror as far as the eye can see. The Ukrainian people are enduring a living hell, and the reverberations are being felt worldwide with skyrocketing food, energy, and fertilizer prices, threatening to spiral into a global hunger crisis. Developing countries were already suffocating under the burden of COVID and the lack of access to adequate financing. Now they are also paying a heavy price as a result of this war. At the same time, we cannot lose hope. From my outreach with various actors, elements of diplomatic progress are coming into view on several key issues. There is enough on the table to cease hostilities now and seriously negotiate now. This war is unwinnable. Sooner or later, it will have to move from the battlefield to the peace table. And that is inevitable. The only question is how many more lives must be lost? How many more bombs must fall? How many Mariupols must be destroyed? How many more Ukrainians and Russians will be killed before everyone realizes that this war has no winners, only losers? How many more people will have to die in Ukraine? And how many people around the world will have to face hunger for this to stop? Continuing the war in Ukraine is morally unacceptable, politically indefensible, and militarily nonsensical.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres at the UN in New York City. He did not elaborate on what he said was those elements of diplomatic progress coming into view on several key issues, and he also did not take any reporters' questions. On Wall Street today, the Dow up 254, NASDAQ up 270, S&P up 50. A tribute to the late Congressman Don Young, Republican from Alaska, longest-serving Republican in U.S. House history, who died Friday at the age of 88, the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell speaking on the Senate floor.
Last week, the United States Congress lost a one-of-a-kind colleague, and the state of Alaska lost an unbelievably devoted champion. Congressman Don Young, the Dean of the House, was the longest-serving Republican in the history of that chamber. He arrived in 1973, and his fellow Alaskans rehired him to represent them every 2 years since. Over the decades, Congressman Young's leadership and advocacy had a literally transformative effect on his home state. He secured resources for Alaska's infrastructure and its people. I understand his office contains with photographs of Don with no fewer than 10 different presidents, each of whom had signed into law a bill that he had written. Don Young first moved to Alaska back in 1959. The same year, it became our 49th state. He once explained his rationale like this: I can't stand heat, and I was working on a ranch, and I used to dream of someplace cold and no snakes and no poison oak. Well, Alaska sure delivered for Don, and starting with a mayoral election in 1964, he spent practically his entire adult life delivering for Alaska in return. Our late colleague across the rotunda wasn't just a legendary legislator and committee chairman, he was also a wildly unique character. Even after decades in public service, he remained every bit the former fisher, trapper, construction worker, gold miner, and tugboat captain. The Senate sends our prayers to Don's family, his staff, and his colleagues who miss him already.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, on the Senate floor. The U.S. House is not in session this week, but we can expect many more tributes to Don Young starting next week when he will be lying in state in the U.S. Capitol. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announcing that and also putting out a statement calling late Congressman Don Young an institution in Congress. She added the photographs of him with 10 presidents of both parties who signed his bills into law that proudly cover the walls of his Rayburn office are a testament to his longevity and his legislative mastery. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Get more top Washington stories each day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word. Just go to c-span.org/connect to sign up. Hope you have a good night.